Welcome to the Subject Composition and Light Photography Podcast. Show notes, links, and contact details can be found at robnunphoto.com. That's www.robnunphoto.com. SCL is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network, and loads of other great tech podcasts can be found over at www.techpodcast.com. Now on with the show. Hi everybody, welcome to SCL, the Subject Composition and Light Photography Podcast. It's the 26th of May 2013, and this is episode 220. Well, it seems like a long time since the last episode. Been very busy at work and at home, etc., but luckily I've got a day off today, so I thought I would take the time to record a podcast. Might be quite a long one, this one, actually. It's going to be a little bit of practice for a video I'm preparing for YouTube on taking sharper photographs with your DSLR. So, for you more advanced photographers out there, you might find that it goes over quite a lot of old ground that you're used to, but for everybody else, there might be the odd thing that you pick up and think, I'll have to have a go with that. I'm not sure how long it's going to take, because again, the idea of doing it is a bit of practice for the video, because it's one thing, for example, me recording podcasts and being able to sort of just chatter on for a while, but when you're in front of a video camera, there's a few more things to worry about in terms of not being able to have a screen in front that I can just simply read off. Although I suppose I could do it like that. So I kind of need to get the words, if you like, the script into my head. But anyway, before we get onto that, first a quick talk about what I've been up to photo-wise. Well, one of the things I did the other morning was spring has kind of sprung here in the UK, and we've had some fantastic blossoms here on the south coast on the trees. And I've been driving past them on the way to work many times, and eventually, of course, the wind comes along and the blossoms go. But the other morning I took 10 minutes just to do a quick photo walk up and down Copner Road where I work, and it really was a case of, right, I've got to do it. It's so easy just to park the car up, go into the store, have a cup of coffee, you know, get ready. And I thought, no, leave for work another 10 minutes earlier and just spend 10 minutes doing it. And it was a beautiful morning, and I'm really glad I did it, because the other thing about going out in the spring and the summer, when the colours are so vibrant, it forces you to shoot in colour. Well, we all shoot in colour, don't we, most of the time if we're doing digital. But it also forces me to post-process in colour rather than doing my usual instant flick over to black and white. And colour post-processing is definitely something I need to work on. I'll put some of the photos in the show notes over at robnunphoto.com for show 220. The shots are okay. I think sometimes I'm a little bit heavy-handed when I'm adjusting colour, because I tend to sort of increase the contrast in the picture and increase the saturation. At the time I think, that looks nice, but normally afterwards I think, I've probably overdone it a little bit. And the other thing I did today was that, because it's a Sunday and me and Oliver and Susanna are all off together, Oliver and Suzanne went to the gym, and that gave me 2 hours again to go on a quick, you know, photo walk. So I kind of thought, well, what am I going to do? Because you think 2 hours isn't that long. But what I did this time was I jumped in the car, dashed down to the ferry, took some photos walking to the ferry, and then took the passenger ferry, which is a foot ferry that, well, for bicycles and motorbikes and going over to Portsmouth, and did a really short photo walk around Queen Street and the Hard and the Portsea area of Portsmouth. And I was quite impressed, actually, because it was such a nice day. Not blindingly sunny, because you can imagine going out between kind of 12 and 2, the sun's pretty high in the sky, but there were some interesting shadows. Not a really blue sky, but, you know, a bluish sky. And some interesting buildings around that particular area of Portsmouth. And what I'm hoping to do as time goes on, where I do get a Sunday off, and Oliver and Suzanne have gone to the gym, I want to cover different parts of Portsmouth, kind of doing, you know, the north end side of it where I work, through to maybe down South Sea Way, more to the east as well, and the parts of Portsmouth kind of facing towards Hayling and that sort of business. Because although Portsmouth is a small area, there's lots of very different areas within it. And I was listening to the Candid Frame photographer podcast during the week, and I can't remember which photographer it was, but it was a guy who's from what city was he? He was from the city that got hit by Hurricane Katrina not that long ago, which was New Orleans. And he was mentioning, you know, the idea of the urban hike, of going for long photo walks in urban areas, because there's all sorts of interesting things you can see. And I always think it's a little bit more exciting as well, because when you're in the countryside, especially in the UK, you know, you're not going to get attacked by wild animals. You're probably not going to get yourself into trouble. You might fall over and hurt yourself, but that's about it. But if you're wandering around a city, you know, especially if that city's maybe got some more deprived areas, and I'm not saying you could get mugged anyway, can you? But it's always a little bit more exciting, I think, as you go down dark alleyways and explore areas that you don't know, that might only be slightly off the beaten track. But anyway, I probably won't be able to post-process those photos and get those ones in the show notes, but I'll put them in my Flickr photo stream over the next week or so. And the whole point of these really short photo walks is to keep me sharp, keep me frosty, as I say, and keep me out there shooting lots of photos, because, again, I do believe that one of the things you've always got to make do as a photographer is, to get better, you need to be taking photographs as often and as you can, and even the smallest little time spans you have to spend on your photography, you should go for it, because that little time span will help you improve and keep your passion going as well, because it's also, I think, a great way of recharging. Because for that, you know, that hour I was probably wandering around taking photographs, that's all I'm really concentrating on, taking photographs. And that artistic outlet, or technical outlet, whichever it is, I guess it's a bit of a balance between the two, just helps me reset myself and re-energise myself. I know I always feel a lot better when I come home, and I'm kind of ready to rock and roll with lots of other things in my life as well. Now, we couldn't really go any further without mentioning the new Flickr. Basically, what's happened is they've given Flickr a big overhaul, it's quite a lot different on the surface. Underneath, it's pretty much the same. But essentially, if you haven't checked it out already, what they've done is they've made the photos a lot bigger, a lot more in your face, with larger photos on like the home screen and in your photo stream. And there's been a mixed reaction to it. Some people have said, oh no, I don't like it. I personally think it's great. I think one of the problems with when you change anything, it's always going to feel uncomfortable, even if you're the sort of person who embraces change. And Flickr hasn't really changed, since I started there, probably about 4 years ago. And what they've done now is quite a revolution in the way that it displays the photos. Initially, basically on your home screen where you go to it, in your photo stream, it kind of tiles them all now, which I think is really nice. When you could dig a little deeper and you go into the groups and the discussions, all that is still really the same in the way you comment. They've overhauled the Flickr app as well for Android. I don't know about iOS, but I guess they have. So it's a lot prettier. Again, it's all about the photos. You know, they're in your face, they're a lot bigger, and they're presented a lot better. The problem, however, and I can understand why people might be annoyed by this, is they've actually gone for really good quality photos. So I guess they're not compressing them as much as they used to. Not that I ever thought the old photos didn't look very good, but because they're a lot bigger, it's using a lot more bandwidth, and pages are slower to load. And if you're on a slow connection, like on your phone, or say you're using a wireless laptop, or there's lots of other people on your home network using using at the same time, some of the pages can load very slowly, and I can understand why that might annoy people. I think maybe one of the things that Flickr should look at is if they've changed the compression on the photos they display and kind of done them at, you know, high resolution JPEGs, then with very little compression, you know, go back to compressing them a little more, because they always look great before, don't they? But overall, I think it's a great move. It looks a lot better, the photos look a lot better. I enjoy looking through my photo stream a lot more than I used to. And I think once they get all the little bugs ironed out and get the speed up again, I think it really is marvellous. And what they've done as well is they've kind of taken away the need to actually buy a pro account now, because everybody gets a terabyte of storage. That's absolutely massive. You know, you won't fill that up, you know, in years and years of uploading your photographs. It really is amazing, the fact that they've done that. You've got to put up with a few ads, but, you know, a terabyte of storage, it used to be you could only put up 200 photos, but now you've got a terabyte. That's hundreds of thousands of photos that you can upload. So I think that's absolutely marvellous that they've done that. And all more strength to Flickr, because people have been leaving it and going to other sites. But I think, you know, just stick with Flickr, come over to the discussion groups, remember it's free to join, and now you get a terabyte of free storage for your photos, so very, very good indeed, very, very, very enjoyable. Now, here we go, the SEL guide to taking sharper photos with your DSLR. I'm just going to pause the recording just for a sec, because I need to go and get a drink, because this bit's going to go on for quite a while, so bear with me, and I'll be right back. Right, that's better. That's better. So, sharper photos. Taking sharper photos with your DSLR, or any camera. And the first thing I'd probably say is, do you really need to worry about how sharp your photos are? A great photo doesn't need to be that sharp. You know, Ant Sullivan said, a sharp photo of a fuzzy concept is one of the worst things. And also, if you're bothering too much about how sharp your photos are, getting too much into the technical side of it, you can lose your spontaneity, the feeling of movement in your photos, and the mystery. So, don't be looking for sharpness for sharpness' sake. But if you do look at your photos and think, actually, you know, they are a little bit blurry, I could do with them being a little bit clearer, then, you know, listen on. Because one of the things that I found, especially when I swapped from my Fuji bridge camera to a DSLR, that it was very, very, very easy to take blur photos with a single lens reflex, because they just don't look after you like your compact or your bridge camera does. My little Fuji, if it was worried the fact that the shutter speed was too long and you were going to get some camera shake, a warning would come up on the screen, you know, a little yellow camera with shake movements next to it, and you go, oh, right, wait a minute, time to boost up the ISO, or stick the camera on a tripod or open up my aperture, sort of thing. And I was quite disappointed when I first got DSLR at how crap so many of the shots were that came out of it, how soft they were. So I'm pretty sure that quite a lot of you have probably come across the same thing. But I think once you've learnt a few concepts, everything becomes much, much simpler, and you get a lot less of those bum shots. And the important thing is, you know, you don't have to be shooting in auto. And moving to the more advanced mode is a lot easier than you think. So, to copy from the wonderful Frodo's Photo podcast and Jared Polin, I guess you could say this is a little bit of a guide to getting out of auto and getting more of the potential out of your DSLR. So, understanding the aspects of technique that affect sharpness is really important, and if we can include these techniques in the way we take photos, that will give us a firm foundation for making other artistic decisions. Because as with anything technical with our photography, the idea is you learn it, you practice it, and it becomes second nature, it becomes subconscious. And that frees you up to think about all the other things. You know, you move beyond worrying about how to get a sharp photo, then you can start thinking about your composition, your subject, and your light, to name but three. And There's a number of aspects of a photo that could be said to make it sharp. These include the accuracy of how you focus, the depth of field, whether there's any camera shake, and whether there's any subject movement, the quality of your lens, how you set up the camera, and the post-processing you do afterwards. And I'm going to talk about these in this podcast. Now, if you're questioning how sharp your photos can get, I'm going to be a bit controversial now. What I'm going to suggest is, for the foreseeable future, shoot in JPEG. Don't shoot in RAW. Because RAW introduces a lot of other issues relating to how you sharpen your photos in post-processing on your computer. And you can kind of get a little bit caught up in the idea that the reason why your photos are soft is because of the way you're post-processing them and not how you've taken them in the camera. So to get kind of a baseline to see what you and your camera and lens combination can produce, switch to high quality JPEGs for a while. How to do this, consult your manual, delve into the settings and choose, I would say, high quality JPEGs. And if you, I know on my camera you have parameters for choosing the kind of picture style, if you like, and I would say choose something with a plus one on the sharpening. And what that means is, when the camera takes the photo and produces the JPEG file that you're going to look at on your computer, it adds a little bit more sharpening than normal. Just have a go with that. Because once you're confident with your technique and ability to produce sharp JPEGs, then move into the world of RAW, because you'll know that you, your camera and your lens can produce a certain quality of photo, and then you'll be able to reproduce that with your RAW processing software. But if you try and jump into RAW straight away, it's another uncertainty that can kind of get in the way. So the first thing I would say is start with the basics if you want sharp photos. Get your camera up, clean the lens with a good quality lens cloth. And something that actually I heard from the Frono's Photo podcast the other day, which I thought was so important, I never thought about it before, is the lens cloth that you use to clean your lens, you know, the glass on the front and the glass on the back of the lens, don't use it to clean your LCD or your eyepiece or your camera in general or your glasses, because when we're looking at the back of our camera with our eye on the viewfinder and our face pressed up against the LCD, all these essential oils are coming off our skin and sticking to the LCD. If we then use our lens cloth to clean that, and then also use that same lens cloth to clean the front of the glass on our lens, all these oils, we're transferring them onto the glass of the lens. So use a separate cloth, and then make sure that viewfinder and that LCD screen are nice and clean as well, so that you can see them. Check your diopter. If you've got an SLR or a DSLR, chances are it has a diopter you can change, and the diopter is the little wheel that sets up the viewfinder so it matches your eyes. Again, have a look at your manual, because it'll tell you how to set it up properly. But generally, you look for the viewfinder, defocus the lens, so put out a manual focus and defocus it, and then just set the diopter so that the little autofocus points look sharp to you. Now, I know we're going to be using our cameras mostly in fully automatic auto-focusing mode, but it helps if we can see the fact that that's working as well. Now, the next step to taking sharp photographs is to do a little checklist with your camera. And I use the WIFE checklist. And the WIFE checklist stands for white balance, ISO, focusing and exposure. So you start off with WIFE for white balance. So I tend to set mine either to auto most of the time or shade. There's lots of discussions about what you should set your white balance to. Auto white balance is great in 99% of situations, but it does mean your white balance changes all the time. Whereas if you're in a, say, a professional situation where you're taking lots of product shots or wedding shots or something, you want a constant white balance, so if there's a problem, you can adjust them all at the same time without having to individually adjust each shot. And so for those purposes, you're better off sticking your white balance on something like shade if you're outside, and then it will give your photos a bit of a pop because it'll warm them up a little bit, but it'll also give you that baseline white balance so you can batch change the white balance should you have to. ISO, for a normal going out taking photographs outside on a sunny day, ISO 100 or 200. Remember that as your ISO goes up, your camera adds noise reduction, and that can lead to photos that seem to lose detail. So we go with ISO 200. Check your autofocus. Is it switched on the lens? Is it on one shot? And that will probably be in your settings. So what I mean by that is, when you press your shutter button, does the lens just focus and then wait for you to press it all the way down? Or is it on like multi or tracking, whereby you press it down and then the lens tracks the subject? For now, let's put it on one shot. So you aim at your subject in the viewfinder, over the centre focusing point, and press the shutter button halfway down. It focuses and it stops trying to focus after that. Speaking of focus points, check your focus point. Is it the middle one? Check your manual to see how to do it. On my camera, you press the focus point button, and then you use the like buttons on the back of the camera to move the focusing point and change it to the middle one. So it's just the middle one. On most cameras, the middle one is the most accurate one, and leave it at that. Image stabilization on your lens. Have you turned it on? Exposure. So what we're going to be doing is shooting an aperture priority mode, to pop into that. Have you added any exposure compensation? So set it back to the base, sort of zero standard. Okay, now we're ready to start practicing. So, you know, by all means, as I'm talking about this, have your camera in your hand and pause the podcast when you want to have a go with some of these ideas. So focusing seems simple, but it's quite easy to get it wrong unless we know what the camera is doing. So we've put our cameras in aperture priority mode, and we're one-shot focusing. And we've made sure we've selected the centre autofocus point, which is the most accurate. So to take a photo, you know, you look through the viewfinder, you use your zoom to do the composition or move your feet, and then we point the camera so that the centre autofocus point is over our subject. We half-press the shutter button down, and the lens will probably move backwards and forwards a little bit, and it'll probably beep at you to tell it's locked in focus. And then if we want our subject in the middle, we press the shutter button all the way down and it will take the picture. However, if you want to do a bit of a composition and get your subject away from the middle, the trick is to keep that shutter button halfway down, and that will lock the focus. So then you can move your view to get the composition you want, and then press the shutter button all the way down to fire the shutter. This technique is called focus and recompose, and it's how you get a subject in focus that isn't in the middle of your picture in a simple way without having to muck around with changing your autofocus point. It's very, very simple to do, and it almost always means that your subject will be in focus. Now, if we or our subject move during the recomposition process, start again. So you center your subject, half press the shutter, recompose, and then press the shutter button all the way down. Now, one of the things you may encounter when using focus and recompose is exposure issues, because the camera is setting the exposure as well when you press the shutter button halfway down. So if your subject is against a bright sky or a dark background, and then you're putting them over to the edge of the screen, then you could get over or under exposure. And then what I would suggest is, if it becomes an issue, you know, read your camera manual, and there's something called automatic exposure lock, or you can select a different autofocus point. But you'll easily overcome these problems. But for now, I would say, if you want to practice getting better, sharper focus, use focus and recompose, focus with the subjects in the middle, then move your lens, and then press the button all the way down. Now, if you're wondering where to focus when it comes to portraits of people or animals, generally it's on the eyes, and generally it's on the closest eye that you concentrate on. That's the one you focus on. And remember, we can play around with the way that our camera locks the focus when we half press the shutter to help us out in certain situations. If we're trying to capture a fast-moving subject that a camera is having trouble locking onto, if we know a point at which that subject is going to pass, say it's a car going around a track, we can point our camera at the ground where that point is, lock in the focus, and wait for our subject to reach it, then press the shutter while you're down. And you can find you can use this in all sorts of tricky situations where you've got a very fast moving subject that's going to pass a predetermined point that you know that you can focus on in advance and then just press the shutter when they come over it. Now, excuse me, before we move on, let's add the big advantage of digital to the mix. Because every photographer, even the most experienced with the best kit in the world, can take a blurred photo very, very easily, even if they've got the best technique. So let's make sure we always take at least two photos of each scene, even better, three. And even if you're sure that you've got the shot, take another one. Because even if you're sure you've got the shot, when you look at the back of your camera at that screen, that also it makes almost every photo look great, and you've really got to zoom in to have a look at it, and even then you're not really sure until you look at it at your computer. So I would say, if you can, always try and take at least two, and even better, three of every single scene. Now, let's talk about why we're in aperture priority mode, and what we can do, because in aperture priority mode, basically what we're doing is we're in control of the hole in the size in the side arc lens, which lets the different amounts of light in. And the reason why we want to be in charge of that is because the size of that hole changes what the depth of field that our camera is focusing on. And we want to be able to take control of that, mainly for artistic reasons. And while we're choosing which size of hole or which size aperture or which size f-stop to use, our camera then adjusts the shutter speed accordingly. So if we're out and about and we want to take, say, a photo of, say, a flower or a person, where we want a very small depth of field, so we just want our subject in focus, but we want the background and the foreground out of focus, we want a big hole, which means we use a little number. So we'd dial in something like f3.5 or f2.8, or maybe you're lucky to have a fast lens, so like an f1.8 or f1.4. If we're out and about and we want to take photos where everything's in focus, like a landscape or a cityscape, we want to use a smaller hole, because a smaller hole leads to a bigger depth of field. And so we'd use a tighter aperture, say something like f8 or f16. Also, when we're doing this, one of the things to always do, if you want a lot of a scene in focus, the rule of thumb to follow is focus a third of the way into the scene, and then almost everything in that scene will be in focus if you're using a tighter aperture like f8 or f16. Now, another reason why it's good to be in control of your aperture, in aperture priority mode, is because of something often referred to as the sweet spot of lenses. Because when they're designing a lens and manufacturing a lens, you can't get a lens that is as sharp, that has maximum sharpness at all apertures. You know, it can't be as sharp at f3.5 as it is at f22. And so, generally, the sweetest spot, the sharpest spot for a lens, is roughly about two stops from wide open. So what that means is probably on most, say, f3.5 kit lenses, the sharp bit would probably be, something like f8 or maybe f5.6, something like that. So if you want sharper photographs, generally, don't shoot at the extreme. So if you've got an f3.5 lens, don't shoot at f3.5, shoot at f5.6. If you've got an f1.8 lens, don't shoot at f1.8, shoot at f3.5. Also, when you're using very tight apertures, such as f22, which you think would be the sharpest, actually they're not. And what you'll probably find is that f16 is actually sharper than f22 because of, I think it's diffraction of light through the lens. Now, before we go on any further, it's worth discussing shutter speed, as this has a massive effect on how sharp our photos would be. Because as we're in aperture priority mode, as we're changing the aperture of the f-stop, the camera we're changing the size of the hole, so the amount of light that's coming in, and the camera's adjusting the shutter speed so we get an acceptable exposure. The problem is that if we're hand-holding, is that if we're using a tighter aperture, or, for example, the clouds come over the sun, or we're going inside where it gets a little bit dark, the shutter speed can get quite long. It can get quite slow. And if it gets too slow, the way we're holding the camera as human beings, we'll get shake in it. And that means the scene in front of us will blur. So how do you know when your shutter speed is too low? Well, basically, the simple way to do it is just look at the focal length you're using, so how long your lens is, and turn that into a fraction, and that will tell you the minimum shutter speed you should be on to avoid camera shake. So, let's say you're using a 18-55 lens. Just look down at the zoom bound and see what it's on. If it's on like 30mm, you know you should be shooting at least a 30th of a second. So put your camera up to your eye, press the shutter button, have a look at the little where it has the shutter speed, and is it higher than a 30th of a second? If it is, you'll be fine. If it's at 50mm, you want to be at a 50th of a second, at least. If you're using a telephoto lens, or we're up at 200mm, you want to be at least at 200th of a second. Now, with modern lenses, we've probably got image stabilization on as well, so that gives us even more elbow room, but let's not worry about it for now. Let's just make sure that we're at least at 1 over the focal length of our lens. And that will make sure that with static subjects, such as buildings and landscapes, we're not going to get camera blur. Because the camera is we're going to be taking the shots at a shutter speed where camera blur isn't going to become a problem. Now, if our subject is moving, we also need to think about that as well. And generally, for people wandering around, we want to be above 250th of a second. For sports, maybe a 500th of a second. If it's motorsports or planes, a 1,000th of a second and higher. So now you're saying, okay, well, I understand that. So if my shutter speed is too low, what do I do? Well, the first thing you can do, because we're in aperture priority mode, we can adjust the aperture. We can make the aperture bigger. Because if you use the aperture bigger, more light's coming in, therefore the shutter speed can speed up. Or we can increase the ISO or sensitivity of our camera. Have a look in your manual, see how you do it. But basically what happens is the camera turns up the gain on the sensor. And there's a lot of gumph out there when you read the internet about how you should always stick to low ISOs. But with modern DSLRs and modern cameras, digital cameras in general, they produce very, very clean images, even at very high ISO. So don't be scared of pushing your ISO up beyond 800. And if you're worried about it, just take lots of test shots of the same subject at all the different ISOs of your camera and have a look at them and see if there's any difference. And you'll probably be very surprised at how good your camera's photos look at even at ISO 1600 and beyond. I mean, I did that with my old 350D. I say old, I mean I'm still shooting with it. So you're just going to take a drink. And what I find is that if I'm out and about shooting outside on a normal sort of day, I tend to start off at ISO 200, and I'll be at something like f5.6 on my kit lens. And if my shutter speed starts getting a bit slow, I'll push the ISO up to 400 first, and then I'll open up my aperture. So I go to like 3.5. If that isn't enough, I'll start pushing up to 800 and then 1600. Of course, all if I'm handling. Now, if you're inside, or it starts to get very dark and your subject is close, at some point you're going to have to introduce artificial light by turning some lights on, using the pop-up flash, or adding some sort of strobe or speed light to the top of your camera. But for now, what I'll say is that your pop-up flash is better than nothing, but by investing in a proper ETTL or TTL speed light, you won't look back when it comes to taking photos inside. They're very, very easy to use. They'll sort everything out, and you can bounce light off all sorts of surfaces and you'll get beautiful photos. Now, chimping or checking your photos on the LCD screen, this is another big advantage of of digital. And what I would say here is that it's important that we check, but do remember, as I've said before, that most photos look great on the back of your camera, even if they're blurred. The important thing is to, on my camera for example, press the info button so you can check the shutter speed that you took the photo of, because you, if you know you, took a photograph and the shutter speed is a 250th of a second and I'm shooting it with a 28mm lens, chances are it's going to be sharp if I focus on the right thing. And then zoom in, press the zoom button to get right in, and then you can have a, that will give you a better idea whether it's blurred or not, and if it looks okay, move on. But it's very important to do this quickly. You know, don't spend minutes looking at the back of your camera, oh, is it alright, isn't it? If you're in doubt, just put the camera back up to your eye and take another photograph, because every second you spend looking at the back of your camera, it's time where we miss the action in front of us. So look at the preview, zoom in, and then move on. So now we should have a pretty good idea on how to take sharper photos with our DSLRs. We're in aperture priority mode. We're shooting near our lens sweet spot. We're not shooting at wide open. And we're keeping an eye on our shutter speed to make sure it's not getting too slow. And, you know, and we know the point of that is that it's the fraction of our focal length. So if we're shooting at 50mm, we know we should be shooting at least 1/50th of a second. We know that if the light starts to go, we can open up our aperture, or we can increase our ISO to keep that shutter speed fast enough. And we also know that for moving subjects, we need to get our subject in faster. So if there are people running around, a 250th of a second. For sports, 500th of a second, and 1,000th of a second for motorsports planes and fast moving subjects. Now, we're taking two or more photos each time. Say 2 to 3 shots per scene, and we're using our LCD screens to chimp fast. We're zooming in, checking the sharpness, and moving on to the next shot. And doing those things will really help out and you with your photos and getting things sharper. But now let's see how we can take it more advanced. What other things can we think about? Well, one of the most basic things that maybe I should talk about at the beginning actually was how to hold your camera. You know, how do you hold a camera? It's a bit difficult to describe on the podcast, but the way to do it is to think of your arm, your left arm, as a bit of a tripod. So what you want to be always doing is keep tucking your elbows in. So you've got the camera, put it against your head, and tuck your left arm so it's against your chest. Don't get too tense, you want to be relaxed, but hold the camera like that. And then breathe softly. And what you should be doing is that when you're breathing out, that's when you press the shutter. Now, if you're shooting at lower shutter speeds, you know, where you're round about, say, a 28th of a second when you're at 28mm, etc., another thing you could do is you can roll the shutter. So practice, instead of pressing your button, jamming it onto jamming it down to take the picture, roll your finger across, and that'll help you move the camera less. Another really good trick as well is, even when you're shooting static subjects, put the camera into continuous shooting, burst mode. You know, because when you're shooting at particularly low shutter speeds, if you take like 5 shots in a row, like ching 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 ching, chances are one of those is going to be sharp, and then in post-processing, you know, pick out the best one. I mentioned it before, but consult your manual and learn how to select the different autofocus points as well. Also, have a look at servo focus or continuous focus or tracking mode on your camera as well, and learn how to select it, and then practice by, you know, tracking on cars and things, and that will help you with moving subjects. Have a go with manual focusing. If you're in a darker environment, sometimes the autofocus on your camera just won't work properly. It will hunt backwards and forwards, or it will want you to put the flash up to fire a strobe, and that can really annoy your subjects. So switch over to manual. Another thing to do is to kind of forget about focusing altogether and use a rule of thumb called F8 and B there. And the idea with this is, what you can do is you just set your aperture to F8, focus, say, about 30 feet away from you, flick your camera to manual focus, and chances are when you're taking shots of landscapes and things, everything's going to be in focus anyway. And the idea with F8 and B there, which came from the old days of people shooting film with manual cameras, you know, what setting should you be at? Well, don't worry about it. If you get to a scene, you know, as a photojournalist, all you need to remember is have your camera at F8 and just shoot away. Other things you can do to steady yourself is to lean against something like a wall, or rest your camera on a wall or a post. Use a tripod or a monopod for really good steadiness, and also sort of moving on from that as well, use a shutter release so you're not actually touching the camera when you press it. Or if you haven't got a shutter release, the next thing to use is use the timer on your camera. And then the kind of the ultimate way to go is to introduce mirror lockup. So again, consult your manual. And the idea with mirror lockup is sometimes in certain situations the mirror will flip up and the camera will shake, and that could affect your photo. Funnily enough, not always on very long exposures. On very long exposures, it doesn't really matter. It tends to be on these kind of middling exposures of like 1 second where a flapping mirror can affect it. But consult your manual and see how to do mirror lockup. The idea of stopping down as well. So, you know, we've talked about depth of field. Well, your camera's probably got a depth of field preview button, so you can actually see what's meant to be in focus. Again, check your camera manual. The problem with stopping down and using a depth of field preview is that the screen can get very, very dark. It'll be difficult to see what's actually in focus. And finally, when it comes to the camera, and I've deliberately left it to last, the lens quality of the camera you're using. There's no doubt that more expensive lenses get sharper. But most, even kit lenses, if you're using them at F8, and you're following all these techniques to get sharper photos, and you're outside on a sunny day, and you focused, you know, properly, chances are, if you were to compare that, even with a very expensive lens, you wouldn't see that much difference. Okay, so don't think that you can spend your way out of this problem. Undoubtedly, for certain situations like sports and wildlife photography, or where you've got very fast moving subjects, having lenses that can focus incredibly fast and cameras that can track things is a big, big Billy bonus. And lenses that have faster apertures at longer focal lengths so that you can keep your shutter speed are very, very important indeed. But for your average amateur photographer like myself, and probably lots of people out there, you know, your lens at F8 or F5.6 is probably, you know, pretty damn sharp in most situations. And, you know, the rest is just technique. Now, I'll mention it a little bit, post-processing. By shooting JPEGs, the idea is we can really minimise that, but most of your post-processing software, whether it be Photoshop Elements, Full Photoshop, Lightroom, Picasa, the GIMP, there'll be some sort of sharpening techniques you can add. Personally speaking, don't do too much, because you don't need to, because most photos, as long as you've taken them in a reasonable manner, will look sharp enough on your photo screen. And by over sharpening something, you can ruin a photo, because really you should keep your sharpening for what we call the output, because depending on how you're outputting it depends on how much sharpening it needs. So, for example, if you're sending a file to a printer to be printed on a nice glossy sheet of paper that's, you know, but it's like a 6x4 or a 5x7, so it's small, it probably won't need much sharpening. If you're putting it onto a large canvas print, you know, you could probably put more sharpening into it. If it's going for a little photo on a website, you probably don't need much sharpening. So don't over sharpen your photos. But things to use, things to look at, I mean, you can look up these in your software's manuals or the internet. Things like, I quite like using the high pass filter. You can use unsharp mask. And always remember, just apply sharpening to the areas that need it, you know. So apply it to the eyes or some details on things. You know. Try not to apply sharpening to areas that don't need it, like the sky, because all you'll end up doing is introducing noise. But don't chase sharpness at the expense of your art. It's a lot easier to come back to old photos in a few years' time and sharpen them up than try and come back to those old photos in a few years' time where you've over-sharpened them and basically ruined them. And finally, don't get too het up about getting ultra-sharp images. You know, if you follow the techniques I've talked about today, you're going to be alright. It'll all become natural, and you won't be chasing the technical ideas. You'll be capturing the moment instead. And as I said at the beginning with the quote from Ansel Adams, there's nothing worse than a sharp photo of a fuzzy concept. And I'd also add that many, many, many of the world's greatest photographs, or even you pick up a copy of a magazine of National Geographic or Vogue or Elle or anything, chances are quite a few of the photos you'll see in there, even the adverts, might or not always be tack sharp, because although tack sharp might give you a level of realism, often we don't always want that in photographs, you know. And just think about that for a minute. Right, so that's it for my little guide on taking sharper photos of your DSLR. Thanks for listening, if you're still with me. Maybe I've missed some ideas out, so put the comments on the blog over at rublandphoto.com, SCL220. If the show notes aren't there yet, you're one of the early listeners, but they will be there over the next week or so. Thank you very much to Everyday Jones, who do the intro and outro music. You can find their stuff for free download at everydayjones.com. Thanks everybody for taking part in the Flickr group, commenting on the photo site, but most of all, I'd like to thank you for downloading and listening to the podcast. My name's Rob from robnonphoto.com. You can email me scalespeeder@gmail.com, and hopefully pretty soon I'll see you on Flickr.